As we approach Earth Day, the ways to understand and employ sustainable investing strategies will rise to the front of your and your clients' minds. Wherever you are on your learning journey, our sustainability certificates can help. Learn more at cfainstitute.org/sustainability. That's cfainstitute.org/sustainability.
Hello and welcome to Guiding Assets, the flagship investment podcast for CFA Institute. I'm Mike Wahlberg, and I'm pleased to welcome Martin Leinweber from Frankfurt today. Martin is a digital asset product strategist at Market Vector Indexes. You may recall we had a good introduction to crypto with Matt Hogan and David Lawant from Bitwise back in September. My goal for today's episode is to further that debate around the inclusion of crypto within balanced portfolios, to better understand the various ways that investors can invest in the space beyond straight-up currencies, as well as the rigor of the valuation methodologies that may support it. So welcome to the show, Martin.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start, unfortunately, Martin, with some bad news. Unless you've been hiding under a rock, virtual or otherwise, you know that the bankruptcy of one of crypto's biggest exchanges, FTX, under cheerleader and recently indicted Sam Bankman-Fried, has created a ripple of doom of sorts within certain corners of the asset class in recent weeks. And this after an already difficult year for crypto investors. The result has been a fall in value of about two-thirds for the biggest names in the space as we record here in December. Perhaps a depressing place to start, Martin, but I wonder if you could please cover the current events portion of the show today and explain exactly what happened with FTX and the impact it's having on the neighboring elements within the crypto ecosystem.
Yeah, you're right. It's very disappointing. I think we can say everything was wrong with FTX. So when we read the CFTC and SEC complaint, it's very interesting. We get an enormous amount of detail. So we know that FTX was knowingly commingling funds with its affiliated market maker and prop shop Alameda from the very beginning. So when FTX was originally founded, FTX also provided Alameda from the very beginning and effectively unlimited credit line. And they even set a flag in the code base, which allowed Alameda to go negative and prevented them from being margin calls. Wow. They even had a preferred API access to FTX, so they had a lower latency compared to other traders. So I think it's fair to say that it was a scam from the start. Now, you hear a lot of bad explanations why this happened. Some say this proves that crypto is a scam. But I have to say that there's really nothing about crypto that caused this to happen at FTX. What happened was that an offshore business reached into the pots where all the customer money was and did stuff with it they weren't supposed to do. And this can happen in any line of business. We have a lot of cases in the traditional finance world with Bernie Madoff, MF Global, and MF Global basically had exactly the same situation. Yeah, they took dollars in client funds and gambled on European sovereign debt. And they lost money and went bankrupt. FTX was a centralized entity that was not following their terms of service and lied to customers. Nothing went wrong with Bitcoin or Ethereum. You can blame Sam Bankman-Fried, and I think you can also blame delinquent investors and poor internal controls. So we have some of the largest and most reputable VCs, and it's very clear that they did not do their homework. Yeah, so they did not do sufficient diligence. They did not install a board. They did not even install a CFO, though, well, we had a chief fraud officer, but not a real chief financial officer. So again, it's not a specific crypto problem, but I do think that we need the same professionalism in crypto as we have in TradFi. So you need a separation between the exchange, the administrator, the custodian, the market maker, etc. It can't be all the same company. And I'm pretty confident that we'll get there. In Europe, we have the MiCA, the Market in Crypto Assets Regulation, which will help to professionalize the crypto market. And my hope is that we'll see the same in the US, although it's much, much harder to say what will happen. We have this alphabet soup of regulators, the SEC, the CFTC, the OCC, then you have the New York BitLicense, etc. and nobody knows who is responsible for what. And I think this has to change. That's important.
Okay, let's get into our discussion here, Martin, and leave the bad news behind. We're going to talk currencies today, as well as non-currency plays within the crypto space. But before we get there, one of the things I'd really like to better understand is the role of tokens in the crypto universe. And I wonder if you could just help our listeners with this basic kind of crypto 101 question and help discern the difference between a coin and a token and how tokens create values for their holders and for their issuers.
Yeah, that's a good and very important question. So the first question we should ask ourselves is, does a token accrue value to the token holder? And what are the things that want to lead me to hold the token? And as you mentioned, the token is the term for everything. When you hear coins, basically it refers to tokens which are issued by blockchains, by the base layer blockchains, such as Bitcoin or Ethereum or Cardano. But at the end of the day, we can all then call token. And we have applications such as Uniswap or the other dApps, digital applications. Generally, we refer to the token world. I think the problem is that most people the first contact for them within crypto is with Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is one of the hardest coins to value because it is a form of money, which is always hard to value and has no cash flows. Bitcoin is sometimes compared to gold, which I think of as a digital version of gold, but this doesn't help either because gold is also hard to value. So what is the main reason why a coin like Bitcoin has a value? And you need to think of it like a network. You can basically say that all of those protocols are networks. So you can use some network models to figure out a value. Now, Metcalfe's law is perhaps the most popular one. It says that the value of a network is equal to the square of the number of users who are connected to it. So it's not just about how many people use a network, but also how many connections those users have with each other. So a simple example is a telephone. If you're the only one who uses it, it's pretty much useless. But if a whole country uses it, that's a whole different story. Now, there isn't a lot of research out there, but I have to mention Timothy Peterson from Kane Island Research, who did a lot of work to model Bitcoin with Metcalfe's law. Now, what he does is even more complicated. So to improve the model, he's adding a sigmoid function, which is a kind of an S-curve, which measures the adoption rate along with interest rates and transaction volumes. So you plot the Metcalfe curve and compare it to the price to see if Bitcoin is cheap or expensive based on its adoption. So if the value of the network goes up as more people use it, why do I need a token then? And that's pretty simple. A token lets you prove that you own that network. It's written down in a very clear way on a blockchain. So classic Web2 networks like Google, Facebook, and Twitter use behavioral economics by giving users dopamine hits when they like or follow something. So Bitcoin is the perfect behavioral network, because it rewards you with a token. And you bring more people into the network and they transact with each other, your value goes up. And let's take Facebook, for example. In Facebook's network, having more users might make your experience better, but you don't gain anything from a stronger network effect. All of this value is for the Facebook stockholder. So in Web2, the user and the shareholder, who gets the value, are kept separate. In crypto, however, it's the user of the network who is important. And this will create tribalism by definition. So since everyone now has a reason to want their network to do better than the other network, and that's why this Bitcoin maximalism exists. You can see the same phenomenon for other protocols. For example, there are the Ethereans, Ethereum network. But keep in mind, there's a huge speculation in crypto, so the difference between the model values and the price can be great in terms of magnitude, but also in terms of duration. So if you like, we can also talk about easier to value cryptos, which have cash flow. We can also talk about stakeholder alignments, which is also very interesting, I think, for your audience.
Yeah, I'd be curious to get into that, and we can circle back to another topic I want to cover, which is how we can kind of group these into categories. But let's go straight to valuations, because I feel like that's within our listener base, that always seems to be the question that comes up, is how, you know, the way you've described the valuation of the currencies themselves, it sounds like, you know, the value is accrued by having more people in the network. And so as long as the people believe, then the value goes up. And maybe I'm oversimplifying that, which is a hard one to put into a model, for example. I know there are other categories, elements within the ecosystem that do generate cash flows and look a little bit more like traditional stocks that we might value. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of the other different pieces of the ecosystem that and how those valuations are being done?
That's true. So it's just easier to value an asset if you have a cash flow. And we have that in crypto as well. So let's take Ethereum, a smart contract platform, and the number two behind Bitcoin. Ethereum also has a network effect, but it also has some cash flows included. Since Ethereum switched from a proof of work consensus algorithm to a proof of stake algorithm, you can now lock your Ether on chain, and in exchange for validating blocks, you get new Ether plus transaction fees caused by the digital applications which live on top of Ethereum. You can always think of it as a kind of a dividend, yeah. So at the moment, you get a 4% annualized return. Now, you can value Ethereum using cash flow analysis again and compare it to other proof of stake networks. You can also compare the issuance of new tokens with the revenue the network provides to measure efficiency. And on top of Ethereum, for example, there are also digital applications that make money. Think about decentralized exchanges. So when you do a business on a decentralized exchange on chain, you pay a fee. Part of this fee goes to the liquidity provider. But some networks deliver this revenue to the token holders or its treasury. And so you can suddenly figure out things like the price to sales ratio and other ratios. For example, the website Token Terminal gives a great overview of tokens, which charges fees and are therefore a source of income. So overall, I think it's much easier to look at crypto from a venture perspective as opposed to looking at crypto from a publicly traded equity perspective. And the question is, what could this token be if the total addressable market grows as to what is this thing like right now? And that mindset is really important. Yeah. And apart from that, it's also a great stakeholder alignment, which is also very interesting in the token world.
Okay, so we have a few different models for it, a number of service providers within the system, exchanges, lenders, and the like. And I know one of the things that you spend a lot of time doing, Martin, is focusing on categorizing these crypto assets. So I'm curious if you could talk a bit today about that work, and maybe tell us, well, what patterns do you see within and between the categories of crypto assets, and how can investors learn from and exploit these patterns?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because we have over 20,000 tokens at the moment. So everybody knows Bitcoin, Ethereum, a handful of other coins, but it's really very demanding to watch all the tokens out there. And what you also see is that Bitcoin dominance is continuously falling. So the Bitcoin dominance is the market cap of Bitcoin in relation to the total crypto market cap. And you see that the dominance is continuously falling and is not even rising in this bear market, indicating that there should be other tokens, other coins out there, which gain investor interest. And so we decided to have a similar approach as in the equity world. In the equity world, you have the chick sectors, yeah, different sectors, financials, oil and gas, consumer staples, yeah, you name it. And so we thought it makes sense to have the same crypto. Of course, not the same sectors, but to classify. And so we, at the moment, look at the top 400, 500 tokens, and whenever they are larger than 250 million in market cap, we do a deep dive. We look at the white paper, we look at third-party research, at Discord channels, and try to identify the end user demand. What is the economic value driver? And so after analyzing all these tokens, we came up with 8 categories. In the meantime, we also have some industry groups and subsectors. And we launched 5 indexes at the category level. So these are, for example, decentralized finance. That's everything which has to do with the traditional finance world built on top of blockchain, for example. I mentioned it before, decentralized exchanges, lending. We have infrastructure applications which take care of all those computational tasks, decentralized storage, which is very important going forward, or oracles bringing off-chain data, external data on-chain. We have one category, which are the centralized exchanges. Yeah, we talked about FTX, but there's also Binance, OKX, and so forth. We have media entertainment, which is also very interesting. These are, for example, tokens which are part of the metaverse, gaming, broadcasting, all the NFT stuff. And last but not least, we constructed an index on smart contract platforms. So that's the base layer chain, which provides the operating system for all the digital applications. On top of that, yeah, think of your iPhone or an Apple Android, iOS, and all the applications on top of that. And this just helps to understand the market better. Because if you look at crypto, it is very narrative driven. We had, for example, 2 years ago in 2020, we had the DeFi summer. So it was all about DeFi protocols. Last year, we had a lot of interest in smart contract platforms being cheaper, better than Ethereum, having more throughput. In Q4 last year, we had Facebook renaming to Meta, and suddenly everybody was interested in Metaverse tokens. And what you maybe don't see in a random basket or even in a top 10 basket, you suddenly can identify that with those categories. So you have a dispersion in returns. Of course, they are all correlated in hard liquidity sell-offs. But what you clearly see is that they act independently, because Bitcoin should have nothing to do with a centralized exchange, and this centralized exchange should have nothing to do with a gaming token. And going forward, we will see more categories. And with the maturity of the market, I think you will also see that correlations are getting lower within the sectors.
Yeah, because I think from a traditional investor perspective, the idea of being able to get exposure that is coin agnostic, or currency agnostic, I guess, and be able to just be a service provider in that world would probably be preferable, so you're not hitching your wagon to any one, you know, Bitcoin versus Ethereum and so on.
That's true. As I said, you have to have a VC perspective. Those tokens are all startup investments from day one, but on a mark-to-market basis. And you have to account for that a lot of them will go to zero. So selecting the right tokens is not easy. Yeah, there are some hedge funds out there, active managers who provide the service, and that makes sense. But I think for a lot of investors, it's just easier to buy a basket according to market cap and getting the crypto return, having the guaranteed crypto return, yeah, buying the winners, selling the losers. And I think that's a good proxy to invest.
So are there any relationships that you can point to across them? I mean, you talked about there were 8 different sort of categories, and you did 5 indexes. And what are the behaviors like of these different categories in terms of relative to one another, and in terms of the diversification benefits that they might provide to a traditional portfolio?
One caveat, we have a relatively short time series in that space. Yeah, so Bitcoin has the longest track record with over 10 years. Then we had Ethereum starting in 2015. A lot of those other coins are just 1 year, 1.5 years old. So we have to be careful when it comes to results. But what you clearly see at the moment is that we had a very long phase of smart contract platforms outperforming everything, which is, I think, an investor preference, which makes sense, because if I don't know which protocol, which digital application will survive, the betting on the base layer chains providing the basic infrastructure and the operating system for all those different applications, whether it's DeFi, NFTs, decentralized social media, etc., makes sense from an investor perspective. And what we also see is that, interestingly, centralized exchange token were still one of the best performers. Yeah, if we cancel FTX out, you still see that Binance is a token which is performing relatively good. And it has something to do also with the tokenomics. Yeah, you have on the one hand a utility token on those exchanges. Yeah, so you can trade efficiently, get a discount, get a better trading experience. On the other hand, a lot of exchanges burn their token according to their profits. So you also an economic component. So you clearly see that there are sectors which are preferred by some investors. And then you have some sectors which really have underperformed over a long time. And these are decentralized finance tokens and all things related to the metaverse, which is surprising. But because there is a lot of demand for metaverse, you read it everywhere. But this has also something to do with the supply and demand dynamics of those tokens, which are very often not beneficial for the token holder. Now, this goes back to what I said at the beginning. You have to ask yourself, how does the token accrue value? And there are some better models, especially in the smart contract platform world. And there are a lot of questionable models, for example, also in the gaming world we've seen so far. And there you see clear trends already. Yeah.
So I want to ask one question about allocations, Anecdotally, it feels a bit like, if you listen to the true believers in crypto and DeFi and so on, they talk about really going all in with large portions of their assets without really potentially accounting for the risk that's being taken there. So my question, I guess, to you is, how much would you suggest your mother put in her 401k?
My mother?
If she was an American and had a U.S. defined contribution plan.
Okay. So, of course, no financial advice. I recommended a little portion to my parents. So when you buy an 80 volatility asset or even higher, position size is really important. And I've written a book in German about asset allocation with crypto assets. And in the book, with my co-author together, we made a very small allocation of 1.5% and took that from the bond allocation. So we cut back on bonds and put more money into stocks. We evaluated different portfolios, and the impact of crypto is more or less the same. So why so small? Yeah. And what you can observe with this small allocation is, when you add an asset with such a high return potential, your overall cumulative return will, of course, go up with the allocation. So more crypto is better. There's almost a linear relationship between how much crypto is added to a portfolio and how much money is made over time. But, here's the but, this return comes with a higher volatility. And as the amount of crypto in a portfolio grows, so does its volatility. But it's interesting that this relationship is not linear. So allocating between 0.5%, 3% of a portfolio to crypto has a small effect on portfolio volatility, but the effect grows quickly as the size of the allocation goes up. And it's very important in finance not to go broke, because if I lose everything, then I'm out of the business. And that's the reason why smaller allocations are often better. The same thing is true for the Sharpe ratio. Adding crypto to a portfolio tends to increase risk-adjusted returns, but adding more crypto has less of an effect after a certain point. This point is between 3 to 4%. And when deciding how much crypto to add to their portfolios, investors probably need to think about maximum drawdowns more than anything else. And as a general rule, allocations below 5% tend to have a little effect on the maximum drawdown. Allocations above 5%, on the other hand, become important. So the maximum drawdown has on average stayed the same for allocations between 1% and 3%. This may come as a surprise to some people since crypto is very volatile, but the crypto returns, on the other hand, are not typically correlated to those of stocks or bonds. And this can help to protect the portfolio against drops. And things change pretty quickly if you add more than 5%. Yeah, the crypto allocation itself starts to cause then maximum drawdowns. And one important aspect, which I have to point out, is think of rebalancing. Yeah, when an asset with a lot of volatility is added to a portfolio, rebalancing is more important than it would be otherwise, especially when you are adding a non-correlated asset. So you buy back the asset to its initial proportion if it has fallen in price, and you sell if the asset had a great performance. So it's implicit buy low, sell high strategy. And that's something a lot of people forget. They keep to their position, hold it, have a nice return, and then they just observe and look how the allocation or the crypto is falling again. And that's pretty important to have this rebalancing feature. Yeah.
Yeah, that rebalancing piece is really important, especially since, as you described, you've got that spike in risk that occurs once you get past 3 or 4%. So you can accidentally end up with a 5, 6, 7% position in there if you don't rebalance back down.
Now, I mean, if you want to maximize your returns, you have to add a lot of crypto, but the risk to go broke is also increasing dramatically. And that's something I have to point out. I've met so many people in the last year being 100% all in crypto, and it's something I just can't recommend. Yeah.
Start small. You're in the speculative territory once you're doing that. You're outside of investing at that point.
Yes. Yeah. True.
All right, Martin, we're running out of time here, so I'm gonna get you with our final question here, and that's what was your first job in the industry? And if you could go back and take yourself for coffee on your first day, what key piece of advice would you offer yourself?
So my first job in the industry was with the asset manager of the Munich Re, as was a mix of strategic asset allocation and relationship management, and it was good and great, but I would say face more risk, yeah? And don't wait too long. Yeah, if you have any dream, go for it. Yeah, and I think that's important. I always changed my positions. Yeah, so I went from a mandate manager to a portfolio manager, from equities or hedge fund analyst to bonds, and now I'm in crypto. And I think that's important. Not being too cautious and having afraid of or be fearful of everything.
I've been joined today by Martin Leinweber, digital asset product strategist at Market Vector Index. Thanks so much for joining me today, Martin.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Mike Wahlberg, and this is me, Guiding Assets.